Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, specifically Life and Debt Web. So I'd like to start a little bit in review from where we left off last week, talking about, can you trust a trust? What is a trust? Well, a trust is a concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. The name came from private banks entrusted with the money of depositors. Paper notes were called fiduciary notes or fiduciary money after the Latin word fide, meaning to trust, because the bankers had to be trusted to keep a sum of gold on hand to redeem their paper receipts on demand. These fiduciary banks played a key role in forming the giant trusts of the Gilded Age. The trusts had their own private banks, which were authorized to create and lend money at will. Like in the board game Monopoly, they used this paper money to buy up competitors and monopolize the game. Monopoly growth and abuse were at their height in the Gilded Age, the country's greatest period of laissez-faire, which is basically let it be, a policy of non-intervention deliberately in the market. Well, the trusts were so powerful that the trend toward monopolizing industry actually worsened after the Sherman Act was passed. And the Sherman Act was the Antitrust Act designed to prevent what actually got exacerbated once the law came into being. Trusts, monopolies. Before 1898, there were an average of 46 major industrial mergers per year. After 1898, the number soared to 531 a year. By 1904, the top 4% of American businesses produced 57% of America's total industrial production, with a single firm dominating at least 60% of production in 50 different industries. With an ironic twist, the trusts became the strongest advocates of federal regulation, since their monopoly power depended on the exclusive rights granted them by the government. However, as today, by planting their own agents in the federal commissions, they used government regulation to gain greater control over industry, protect themselves from competition, and maintain high prices. And of course, the trusts were related to the robber barons. During that period of the late 1800s and early 1900s, there were many, many robber barons, but J. Pierpont Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, and John D. Rockefeller led the pack. Morgan dominated finance, Carnegie dominated steel, and Rockefeller monopolized oil. Carnegie built his business himself, and he loved competition, but Morgan was a different type of capitalist. He didn't build, he bought. He took over other people's businesses, and he hated competition. In 1901, Morgan formed the first billion-dollar corporation, U.S. Steel, out of mills he purchased from Carnegie. Rockefeller, too, dealt with competitors by buying them out. His company, Standard Oil, became the greatest of all monopolies and the first major multinational corporation. Before World War I, the financial and business structure of the United States was dominated by Morgan's finance and transportation companies and Rockefeller's Standard Oil. And these conglomerates had close alliances with each other. Through interlocking directorships, they were said to dominate almost the entire economic fabric of the United States. Other industrialists, seeing the phenomenal success of the Morgan and Rockefeller trusts, dreamt of buying out their competition and forming huge monopolies in the same way. But with the exception of Carnegie, no other capitalists had the money for these predatory practices. Aspiring empire builders were therefore drawn to Morgan and the other Wall Street bankers in search of funding. Corporations began drifting to New York to be near the big investment houses. By 1895, New York had become the headquarters for America's major corporations and the home of half its millionaires. Morgan's bank at 23 Wall Street, known as the House of Morgan, was for decades the most important address in American finance. In 1920, a bomb exploded in front of the bank, killing 40 and injuring 400. Later, the nexus of American finance moved to the World Trade Center, which we know, unfortunately, was the chosen target for another tragic attack in 2001. Early in the 20th century, Morgan controlled a Wall Street syndicate that the financial writer John Moody called the greatest financial power in the history of the world. Morgan dominated 100 corporations with more than $22 billion in assets. At that time, it's phenomenal. In 1913, in a book called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis wrote that the greatest threat to the American economy was the money trust. According to the Wall Street Journal, the money trust was just another name for J. Pierpont Morgan, who had founded the world's most powerful bank. Like the Rothschilds in England, Morgan had extraordinary political influence in the United States. Morgan men routinely represented the United States government at international monetary meetings, something they continue to do even today. Alan Greenspan, longstanding chairman of the Federal Reserve, was a corporate director for J.P. Morgan before President Ronald Reagan appointed him to that post. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to the corporations. The fortunate corporations, favored with funding from Morgan and the other Wall Street bankers, were able to monopolize their industries. But where did the Wall Street banks get the money to underwrite all these mergers and acquisitions? The answer was revealed by Congressman Wright Patman and other close observers. The robber barons were pulling money out of an empty hat. Their privately owned banks held the ultimate credit card, a bottomless source of accounting entry money that could be lent to their affiliated corporate mistresses. The funds could then be used to buy out competitors, corner the market in scarce raw materials, make political donations, lobby Congress, and control public opinion. Now, who pulled the strings of the robber barons? Rockefeller and Morgan were rivals who competed for power on the political scene, but they both had the support of powerful British financiers. John D. Rockefeller Sr. first made his fortune with some dubious railroad rebate deals during the Civil War. In 1895, he had acquired 95% of America's oil refining business. Chase Bank, named after Salmon P. Chase in honor of his role in passing the National Banking Act, was bought by Rockefeller with financing traced to the Rothschilds. The funds came from a New York banking firm called Kuhn, Loeb & Company, which was then under the control of a German immigrant named Jacob Schief. Schief had bought into the partnership with financial backing from the Rothschilds. He later bought out Kuhn and married the eldest daughter of Loeb. The Manhattan Company, the banking firm established by Hamilton and Burr at the turn of the 19th century, also came under the control of the Rothschilds through the banking interests of Kuhn, Loeb, and the Warburgs, another Rothschild-related Frankfurt banking dynasty. In 1955, Rockefeller's Chase Bank merged with the Manhattan Company to become the Chase Manhattan Bank. The Morgan family banking interests could be traced back to England in an even more direct way. In the 1850s, Junius Morgan became a partner in what would become Peabody, Morgan & Company, a London investment business specializing in transactions between Britain and the United States. During the Civil War, the partnership became the chief fiscal agent for the Union. John Pierpont Morgan, Junius's son, later became head of the firm's New York branch, which was named J.P. Morgan & Company in 1895. J.P. Morgan Jr., John Pierpont's son, then became a partner in the branch in London, where he moved in 1898 to learn the central banking system as dominated by the Bank of England. Although the Rothschilds were technically rivals of the Peabody Morgan firm, rumor had it that they had formed a secret alliance. Nathan Rothschild was not well liked, in part because of religious prejudice. Morgan biographer George Wheeler wrote in 1973, "Part of the reality of the day was an ugly resurgence of anti-Semitism. Someone was needed as a cover." August Belmont, born Schoenberg, had played that role for Rothschild during the Civil War, but when the Belmont-Rothschild connection became common knowledge, the ploy no longer worked. Wheeler wrote, "Who better than J. Pierpont Morgan, a solid Protestant exemplar of capitalism, able to trace his family back to pre-revolutionary times?" That could explain why, in the periodic financial crisis of the Gilded Age, Morgan's bank always came out on top. In the bank panics of 1873, 1884, 1893, and 1907, while other banks were going under, Morgan's bank always managed to come up with the funds to survive and thrive. This leads to the concept of the shadow government. In 1879, Rockefeller turned his company, Standard Oil, into the new vehicle called a trust in order to coordinate all of its production, refining, transportation, and distribution activities. The Rockefeller Trust consisted of a network of companies that were wholly or partially owned by Rockefeller and that invested in each other. The scheme worked until 1882, when Standard Oil was driven out of Ohio due to antitrust investigations. In 1883, Rockefeller's trust moved to New York, where it proceeded to systematically devour independent oil producers and refiners across the country and the world. It was aided in these rapacious practices by illegal railroad rebates from Morgan, who had bought up the railroad with funding from the Rothschilds Bank. Independent oil refiners, being unable to compete, were forced to sell out at a huge loss or face financial ruin. By 1890, Rockefeller owned all of the independent oil refiners in the country and had a monopoly on worldwide oil sales. In 1911, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Standard Oil cartel was a dangerous conspiracy that must be broken up for the safety of the Republic. Conspiracy is a legal term meaning an agreement between two or more persons to commit a crime or accomplish a legal purpose through illegal action. In 1914, Standard Oil was referred to in the Congressional Record as the shadow government. Following the court's antitrust order, the Standard Oil monolith was split into 38 new companies, including Exxon, Mobil, Amoco, Chevron, and Arco, but Rockefeller secretly continued to control them by owning a voting majority of their stock. The invention of the automobile and the gasoline engine gave the Rockefeller Morgan Syndicate a virtual stranglehold on the energy business. Rather than conserving oil and finding alternatives to the inefficient gasoline engine, they encouraged waste and consumption and ruthlessly suppressed competition. International strategist Henry Kissinger would say much later that whoever controlled oil controlled the world. That was true so long as the world was powered by oil, and the oil cartel evidently intended to keep it that way. Early in the 20th century, energy genius Nikola Tesla was reported on the verge of developing free energy that would be independent of both fossil fuels and wires. But Tesla had the ill fortune of being funded by J.P. Morgan. When Morgan learned that there would be no way to charge for the new energy, he cut off Tesla's funding and took steps to ensure the latter's financial ruin. Tesla wrote in a plaintive letter to Morgan, "I came to you with the greatest invention of all times. I knew you would refuse. What chance have I to land the biggest Wall Street monster with the soul's spider thread?" If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's move on to the next chapter of the Web of Debt, The Witch's Coven, the Jekyll Island Affair, and the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. And again, The Wizard of Oz, the discovery of Oz the Terrible. He said that one of my greatest fears was the witches. For while I had no magical powers at all, I soon found out that the witches were really able to do wonderful things. And this, of course, is from the book The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which actually is an allegory about the financial condition of the United States at the end of the 1800s into the early 1900s. If the Wall Street bankers were the wicked witches of the Gilded Age, the coven where they conjured up their grandest of schemes was on Jekyll Island, a property off the coast of Georgia, owned by J.P. Morgan. The coven was hosted in 1910 by Senator Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island, a business associate of Morgan and the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. The Republican whip in the Senate, Aldrich, was known as the Wall Street Senator, a spokesman for big business and banking. Although Aldridge hosted the meeting, credit for masterminding it is attributed to a German immigrant named Paul Warburg, who was a partner of Kuhn Loeb, the Rothschilds' main American banking operation after the Civil War. Other attendees, including Benjamin Strong, then head of Morgan's Bankers Trust Company, two other heads of Morgan Banks, the Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, and Frank Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank of New York, then the most powerful New York bank, which, by the way, is now called Citibank, which represented William Rockefeller and Kuhn Loeb. Of course, Morgan was the chief driver behind the plan. The Morgan and Rockefeller factions had long been arch rivals, but they had come together in this secret rendezvous to devise a banking scheme that would benefit them both. Vanderlip wrote later of the meeting, quote, "We were instructed to come one at a time and as unobtrusively as possible to the railroad terminal where Senator Aldrich's private car would be in readiness. Discovery, we knew, simply must not happen. If it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had written a banking bill, that bill would have no chance whatever of passage by Congress. Although Aldrich's Federal Reserve Plan was defeated, its essential points were contained in the plan that was finally adopted." End of quote. Congressional opposition to the plan was led by William Jennings Bryan and Charles Lindbergh Sr., who were strongly against any bill suggesting a central bank or control by Wall Street money. It took a major bank panic to prompt Congress even to consider such a bill. The panic of 1907 was triggered by rumors that the Knickerbocker Bank and the Trust Company of America were about to become insolvent. Later, evidence pointed to the House of Morgan as the source of the rumors. The public, believing the rumors, proceeded to make them come true by staging a run on the banks. Morgan then nobly helped to avert the panic by importing $100 million worth of gold from Europe to stop the bank run. The mesmerized public came to believe that the country needed a central banking system to stop future panics. Robert Owens, a co-author of the Federal Reserve Act, later testified before Congress that the banking industry had conspired to create such financial panics in order to rouse the people to demand reforms that serve the interests of the financiers. Congressman Lindbergh charged, quote, "The money trust caused the 1907 panic. Those not favorable to the money trust could be squeezed out of business, and the people frightened into demanding changes in the banking and currency laws which the money trust would frame." End of quote. The 1907 panic prompted the congressional inquiry headed by Senator Aldrich, and the clandestine Jekyll Island meeting followed. The result was a bill called the Aldrich Plan, but the alert opposition saw through it and soundly defeated it. Bryan said he would not support any bill that resulted in private money being issued by private banks. Federal Reserve notes must be Treasury currency issued and guaranteed by the government, and the governing body must be appointed by the president and approved by the Senate. Actually, Morgan had another problem besides the opposition in Congress. He needed a president willing to sign his bill. William Howard Taft, the president in 1910, was not a Morgan man. McKinley had been succeeded by Vice President Teddy Roosevelt, who was in the Morgan camp and had been responsible for breaking up Rockefeller's Standard Oil. Taft, who followed Roosevelt, was a Republican from Rockefeller's state of Ohio. He took vengeance on Morgan by filing antitrust suits to break up the two leading Morgan trusts, International Harvester and United States Steel. Taft was a shoo-in for re-election in 1912. To break hold on the presidency, Morgan deliberately created a new party, the Progressive or Bull Moose Party, and brought Teddy Roosevelt out of retirement to run as its candidate. Roosevelt took enough votes away from Taft to allow Morgan to get his real candidate, Woodrow Wilson, elected on the Democratic ticket in 1912. Roosevelt walked away realizing he had been duped and the Progressive Party was liquidated soon afterwards. Wilson was surrounded by Morgan men, including Colonel Edward Mandel House, who had his own rooms at the White House. Wilson called House his alter ego. To get their bill passed, the Morgan faction changed the bill's name from the Aldrich Bill to the Federal Reserve Act and brought it 3 days before Christmas when Congress was preoccupied with departure for the holidays. The bill was so obscurely worded that no one really understood its provisions. The Aldrich team knew it would not pass without Bryan's support, so in a spirit of apparent compromise, they made a show of acquiescing to his demands. He said happily, "The right of the government to issue money is not surrendered to the banks. The control over the money so issued is not relinquished by the government." End of quote. Well, so he thought, but while the national money supply would be printed by the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing, it would be issued as an obligation or debt of the government, a debt owed back to the private Federal Reserve with interest. And while Congress and the President would have some input in appointing the Federal Reserve Board, the board would work behind closed doors with the regional bankers without congressional oversight or control. So we see the birth of the American nightmare. The bill passed on December 22, 1913, and President Wilson signed it into law the next day. Later, he regretted what he had done. He is reported to have said before he died, "I have unwittingly ruined my country." Bryan was also disillusioned and soon resigned as Secretary of State in protest over President Wilson's involvement in Europe's war following the suspect sinking of the Lusitania. The first chairmanship of the Federal Reserve was offered to Paul Warburg, but he declined. Instead, he became vice chairman, a position he held until the end of World War I, when he relinquished it to avoid any apparent conflict of interest. He would have had to negotiate with his brother Max Warburg, who was then financial advisor to the Kaiser and director of the Reichsbank, Germany's private central bank. So, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was a major coup for the international bankers. They had battled for more than a century to establish a private central bank with the exclusive right to monetize the government's debt, that is, to print their own money and exchange it for government securities or IOUs. The Act's preamble said that its purposes were to provide for the establishment of the Federal Reserve banks to furnish an elastic currency, to afford a means of rediscounting commercial paper, to establish a more effective supervision of banking in the United States, and for other purposes. This was the beginning of Fed speak, abstract economic language that shrouded the issues in obscurity. We see that elastic currency is credit that can be expanded at the will of the banks. Rediscounting is a technique by which banks are allowed to magically multiply funds by relending them without waiting for outstanding loans to mature. In plain English, the Federal Reserve Act authorized a private central bank to create money out of nothing, lend it to the government at interest, and control the national money supply, expanding or contracting it at will. And we will continue during the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeindebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.